Richard Linklater is the director of such contemporary cinema classics as Dazed and Confused, about the last day of high school in the 1970s. School of Rock, starring Jack Black, and the Before trilogy, starring Ethan Hawke and Julie Delphi. Now, to see who I'm dealing with this morning, who has seen Dazed and Confused? All right. School of Rock? Okay. The Before trilogy, any of them? Okay, a few. We only had one in the early service. All right. Of those films, the Before trilogy is where we first begin to see Linklater's willingness to risk playing the long game. Before Sunrise came out in 1995, and it's about a young American man named Jesse and a young French woman named Celine who meet randomly and spend just one night together talking as they walk through the streets of Vienna. The only time they have together is, you can guess it, before sunrise. Now, here's the twist. The next two installments, Before Sunset in 2004 and Before Midnight in 2013, were filmed and released in 9-year intervals, respectively, so a total of an 18-year span for the whole trilogy so far, and with the same two actors, who are, of course, themselves literally 9 years older, playing the same characters as if those characters, which they were, 9 years older, with the details of the plot infused and influenced by things that had happened in the actor and the director and their family and friends and the actual lives during those 9 years. And bearing any unforeseen tragedies in the lives of Linklater and Hawke and Delphi, we may well see a fourth installment somewhere around 2022. In the meantime, if you haven't seen the first three, I recommend them. But the point is that Linklater is very interested in coming-of-age stories. He's very interested in ordinary life and how we're all swept up and inexorably influenced by the flow of time. And although I'm a big fan of the Before trilogy, the real critical acclaim for Linklater has come this summer with the release of the film Boyhood. Has anyone made a pilgrimage to see Boyhood? It hasn't come. All right, a few, two. Okay, Megan and I did as well. We went to see it at the AFI at Silver Spring. You can still see it, but you've got to drive about 45 minutes. It has unfortunately not come to Frederick. But it's received a lot of critical acclaim, and you may have read about it. And it'll be on DVD eventually. But here's the deal. In 2002, 2 years prior to filming the second installment of the Before trilogy, Linklater cast the 6-year-old Eller Coltrane as Mason, the star of his movie, that had the working title 12 Years. Now, it was changed to Boyhood, you may can guess, because in 2013, just before, 12 years into it, he's getting ready to finally release the film, and this small little film called 12 Years a Slave comes out and wins the Best Picture Oscar and all that, so they changed it to be Boyhood. But Linklater's achievement over those 12 years is a powerful example of the old saying that almost every day we overestimate what we can get done in a 24-hour period, but we underestimate what we can accomplish in a decade. The cast came together once a year for 12 years to create a film whose plot, similar to the Before series, organically evolved over time. It's sort of loosely structured, but things that happened in the actual lives of the team putting the film together influenced it. And the film itself is simply those 12 segments, edited down and then edited together so that you see Eller grow up, or I guess Mason, his character, from moments in his life as a first grader all the way through over 12 years till his first day at college. And as with the Before trilogy, what's fascinating about Boyhood is it is a profound artistic and spiritual meditation about time. As the writer of Ecclesiastes says, time and chance happen to us all. And Linklater cast his own daughter as the co-star, so he took a risk and said, I'm going to cast this 6-year-old boy and trust that his parents are going to continue to give me access to him for the next 12 years. He felt pretty good about that, but instead of doubling down on that, he said, my daughter's still a minor, and I know where she's going to be for the next 12 summers. So he cast her, and she was actually really excited and loved it, but then as a teenager, she became a little disaffected with the whole process, and she actually said, Dad, can my character, die? To which Linklater had to say, No, that would be a little dramatic for what I have intended for this film, which actually points to the heart of the film's brilliance. Train wrecks, of course, happen to us sometimes in our life, but Boyhood is really much more about the mundane, the average, the ordinary, and the triumphs and the travails of everyday life. And there are, of course, plenty of movies that cram an incredible amount of, you know, tragedy into 2 hours, but that's not what this film is about. It's about coming of age. It's about parenting. It's about surviving adulthood. And this morning, I want to invite us to reflect on the spirituality of the ordinary. And it's no coincidence that another of Linklater's long-term projects that he's been working on again for more than a decade and still is not completed is about one strand of our Unitarian Universalist forebears, the 19th century Transcendentalists, Emerson, Thoreau, Margaret Fuller, and many others who powerfully challenged the religious establishment of their day with the insight that spiritual depth was much more to be found in the here, in the now, in nature, than in antiquated notions that holiness and the sacred was only in the past or only in sacred sanctuaries. And as we'll hear later during the offertory, the Transcendentalists taught us that everything is holy now. Allen Ginsberg famously wrote about that in his poem, How. That insight resonates deeply, too, with the universalist half of our UU heritage, which has evolved from a focus on universal salvation in a next world to a universal call to love the hell out of this world right here and now. And in contrast, the history of spirituality has often been an emphasis on the sacred can only be found in certain people, like priests, and only in certain holy places that are usually cordoned off. And only at certain times, special holy days. And while we should recognize and honor that there are sacred holy times in our world and in our lives, it's also vital to reclaim the sacredness of the everyday and the ordinary. But again, the history of most spiritual traditions have emphasized just the opposite. The superiority of a professional clergy class, that Christian or Buddhist monks, Hindu gurus, or Jewish men who spend all day studying Torah are allegedly able to achieve some level of special holiness unreachable for regular folk. But might there also be some level of ordinary sacredness that is not experienced if you spend your whole life cloistered away? Because increasingly that orthodoxy, the traditional orthodoxy, is being questioned. So on one hand, mountaintop monastics who spend all their time in a retreat setting, they may legitimately and likely do have legitimate, valuable, contemplative insights to share with us, those of us who often find ourselves crazy busy, the opposite of contemplative. On the other hand, many regular folk have been wounded over the years by monastics or by celibate clergy who, with little to no experience in the secular world, have nevertheless felt it was their duty to issue decrees from on high about how all humanity should live, decrees often unrealistic unless you're living in a retreat setting, with no family obligations and with no financial obligations because your salary is paid by free will donations from those people that you're criticizing who spend all their time working. Indeed, the more difficult and important spiritual challenge of our time may be cultivating a greater appreciation for the sacredness of each new present moment in our ordinary lives. For example, in Buddhism, one of the gold standards is going on a 3-year retreat. Not a 3-day retreat, not a 3-week retreat or a 3-month retreat, a 3-year retreat. And as powerful as people testify that those experiences are, and I have no doubt that you would be transformed by spending 3 years in a cloistered retreat, instead, the much more realistic option, because for most people, a 3-year retreat, even in retirement, is just not an option. Instead, the much more important task is integrating the wisdom of the world's religious traditions right now into your everyday life. Whatever your path, I invite you to consider that even more important than your experience during your spiritual practice, whatever that spiritual practice is how the fruit of that practice is borne out every moment of your day. While I care about how you experience the sacred during your spiritual practice, I'm even more interested in whether your spiritual practice leaves you more connected to your deepest self, more connected to everyone you meet, more connected to this world throughout the day. Whether your spiritual practice helps you be a more grounded, more centered, and better coworker, partner, and parent, not just during the theoretical few minutes when, you know, you're on your yoga mat in a pose, you're like, I feel really ready to be a parent right now, but then you walk right out, right? And your kids are like little Zen masters, and they're better than any Zen master in a retreat setting, throwing you off your game. You know, so it's not just about what you experience on your meditation mat, it's how that you bring and integrate that centeredness throughout your day. The point is transforming how we experience the ordinary. You can know that you're on the right track if in your spiritual practice, in the words of the Christian tradition, you increasingly see more love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and gentleness and self-control. If your spiritual practice, when you're doing it, if it leads to more of that throughout your day and throughout your week and throughout your life, or in the words of the Buddhist tradition, if you're seeing more tendencies to being generous, to renunciation, to wisdom, strength, effort, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity, if you're seeing the fruit of those things born out in your life, your spiritual practice is on the right track. If it's not, then set up a time and let's talk about what you're doing. We'll reevaluate. The point of religion is not only some form of like fancy quantum spirituality that seeks to solve the mysteries of metaphysics, but also, and here's your SAT word for the day, it's not quantum spirituality, but quotidian spirituality, which just means the everyday, the commonplace, the ordinary, and integrating the wisdom of science and the world's religions into your everyday life. As the spiritual teacher Henry Nouwen writes in a paragraph that seems freshly relevant in light of recent headlines of ISIL and Syria and so many other things, Nouwen writes, "Not too long ago, a priest told me that he canceled his subscription to the New York Times because he felt that the endless stories about war, crime, power games, political manipulations, they only disturbed his mind and heart and prevented him from meditation and prayer. That's a sad story because it suggests that only by denying the world can you live in it, that only by surrounding yourself with an artificial self-induced quietude can you live a spiritual life. A real spiritual life does exactly the opposite. It makes us so alert, so aware and engaged with the world around us in a healthy way that all that is and happens becomes a part of our contemplation and meditation, and invites us to a free and a fearless response. In a world filled with fear-mongering and demagoguery, Nouwen reminds us of the hope that through spiritual practice, we might become more contemplative, grounded, and centered, such that whatever comes, we might bring a free and fearless response. At the same time, I don't intend to imply that the point is some sort of free and fearless response, some sort of one-time act of heroism. It might be that, but that's not the point of what I'm trying to say today. Rather, the invitation is to ever more fully see the sacred in every ordinary moment. As Kathleen Norris writes in her book, The Quotidian Mysteries, the ordinary activities that I find most compatible with contemplation are walking, baking bread, and doing laundry. As the that may or may not be true for you, but as the Carrie Newcomer song sang earlier in our musical meditation, to pray as only laundry can. So you have to decide, what is it for you, right? What is your ordinary mystery? It may or may not be laundry. Or as the 8th century Muslim Sufi mystic Rabia of Basra wrote, it helps putting my hand on a pot. So instead of just trying to sit on his meditation mat, it helps putting my hand on a pot or a broom or in a washing pail. And I tried painting, but it was easiest to fly slicing potatoes. Along those lines, one of my favorite books on ordinary spirituality is Jack Kornfield's After the Ecstasy, The Laundry. Religion is as much about the mundane as it is about the mountaintop. In Cornfield's words, we all know that after the honeymoon comes the marriage. After the election comes governance. In spiritual life, it is the same. After the ecstasy comes the laundry. And it's understandable to want a great honeymoon, to win an election, to have a powerful spiritual encounter. But who cares about a great honeymoon if your marriage is falling apart? Who cares about a landslide election if your governing is corrupt or inept? Who cares about a passing moment of spiritual rapture on your meditation cushion if your everyday interactions don't lead to more humility, to more kindness, to more compassion with whomever you meet? The mountaintop moments will always be fleeting, even for those who live on the mountaintops. The invitation is to see the ordinary moments as sacred too. As we reflect on our ordinary lives, the poet Jean Valentin reminds us, "Blessed are they who remember that what they have now they once longed for." Your life will always be imperfect, but what do you have now that you can celebrate that before now you always longed for? In that spirit, to share only one of many interviews from Cornfield's book. So what he does is he went around and interviewed a lot of Buddhist masters, but he also interviewed their children and their spouses and their partners, and about how are they not only on the retreat setting, how are they in the grocery store, how are they at home. So one woman said, "As a young Catholic before becoming a Buddhist, I was inspired by the saints. I'd always wanted to do things like the work of Mother Teresa in India. But most of my life has not been so glamorous. After college, I became a teacher in an elementary school, and then my mother had a stroke, and I had to drop out of teaching and help her for 2 years. Bathe her, care for her bed sores, cook, pay the bills, run the house. At times, I just wanted to be done with those responsibilities and get back to my spiritual life. And then one morning, it dawned on me. I was doing the work of Mother Teresa, and I was doing it in my own home." That's real spirituality. That's ordinary spirituality that is equally or more demanding, challenging, and profound, just like parenthood is for many people, just like your job can be for many people, that's more profound than anything you will ever experience on a mountaintop retreat. That marriage, being a partner, that is over a lifetime, is more difficult or equally as difficult as spending your life in a mountaintop retreat or on a 3-year retreat. As we UUs like to often say, we believe in deeds, not creeds. So allow me to conclude with some lyrics from the Quaker singer-songwriter Carrie Newcomer. You heard earlier her song, "Holy as the Day is Spent." This is from her song, "I Believe." As I read these words, I invite you to continue reflecting on, where do you experience the sacred in the ordinary? Or where might you begin or feel called to claim that, be more aware of savoring the sacred in the ordinary? Newcomer begins, "I believe in a good, strong cup of ginger tea, and that all these shoots and roots will become a tree." And that's a lot like boyhood. That's a lot like the Before trilogy, that you kind of look out and you see these shoots and roots, but you know that if you've ever seen time-lapse photography, they're going to become a tree, and trusting in the passage of time and the wisdom that's going to emerge. Newcomer continues, "All I know is I can't help but see all of this as so very holy. I believe in jars of jelly put up by careful hands, and I believe that most folks are doing about the best they can. I believe in a good long letter written with real paper and real pen. I believe in the ones I love and know I'll never see again. I believe in the kindness of strangers and the comfort of old friends. And I know that I get scared sometimes, but I know that all I need is here. All I know is I can't help but see all of this as holy."